Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Monica Wilkie. I'm the host of New Books in Media and Communication, a podcast on the New Books Network. Today, we're going to be talking to Mike Anany about his latest book, Networked Press Freedom, Creating Infrastructures for a Public Right to Hear. Mike, welcome to the channel.
Hi, Monica. Thank you very much. It's great to chat with you.
Likewise. So before we get into the meat of your book, can you just give us a brief bio about yourself and tell us how you came to write this book?
Sure, yeah. So I'm an associate professor at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, and I teach and do research across both areas in communication and in journalism. And I mostly, a lot of my work sort of focuses on this idea of what kind of public life is created at this intersection of journalism and technology. So anytime that news organizations sort of create technology or use social media or partner with technology companies, I'm interested in the kind of clues that they leave about how they understand public life, you know, who they think the public is and what they think they can do about public issues and what they think they owe to the public. So the book was really sort of born out of those kinds of concerns of trying to say, in this sort of environment where journalism is changing, technology companies and platforms are becoming increasingly powerful, we're seeing this intertwining of really the work of news and the work of software creation. So I was sort of curious, what sort of sparked my curiosity was what kind of press emerges from those kinds of relationships and those kinds of intersections.
The title of your book is Network Press, and you use this phrase throughout your work. Can you give us a definition of what you mean by the networked press?
Right. Yeah. So, but I mean by the networked press is I mean all of the different kinds of people and institutions and technologies and practices that go together, that fit together to produce what we consider, quote, news. And I put sort of news in quotation marks because I think we've historically thought about news as what news organizations produce. We've sort of thought about news as what journalists make. They go, they observe the world, they go out into the world, they report on the world, that is published through, you know, traditional media channels, and that becomes news. It becomes information that is assumed to have public importance and that's assumed to sort of have a public power. So what I mean by networked press is to say all of those people and practices and sort of rituals and routines are now living in other places. They're no longer living just within newsrooms. They're living in software companies. They're living in advertising technology agencies. But they're also living in groups or communities of what we, you know, what technology companies would call, quote, users. These people that we used to think of as readers are now users. And all of those forces sort of create for us what we consider news to be today. So when Facebook creates an algorithm that makes some news appear more likely than other news, when you or I as a user click on or retweet or forward or comment on one piece of news versus another piece of news, we collectively are providing a lot of signals about what news is thought to be, and how it has power. And that's a really different world than the world of broadcast media and of traditional news work as things that happen within news organizations. So that's kind of what I mean by networked press freedom.
You talk about the public right to know. Can you just define what you mean by this, and who decides what the public should and shouldn't know?
Right. That's one of sort of the central claims of the book. And it's related to that distinction between sort of the press and the network press. But the old way, I think, of thinking about press freedom was these were sort of heroic and very individual journalists who were pursuing what they thought the public needed to know and to hear to be a democratic, self-governizing, sort of self-organizing group. And I think the concept was, if we just sort of leave these journalists alone to speak, to report, to print, to publish, and we give them access and we give them a lot of independence from other forces, if we did all of that, then the public would know what it needs to know. And I think there's a couple problems with that. One of them is that it kind of leaves this power to define what the public needs with journalists themselves. It assumes that journalists have a, you know, really mature and sort of well-developed notion of what quote the public is, and they can think about the public in different ways. And many journalists do think about this in a subtle and nuanced way. But what I was trying to get at with this idea of a public right to hear is sort of decouple it from the assumptions that journalists might have and sort of the power that journalists have to do their work. What I wanted to do is to say, well, maybe there's some other kind of sort of public making power that is related to but separate from what we just assume journalists to do and have always given journalists the power to do.
So you discussed that when you were talking about the public right to know, you were talking about journalists. And when you talked about networked press, you brought in all these various software companies, Facebook, those sort of platforms that are now part of this space as well. Do you think a lot of the tensions in this space could come from that journalists and these platforms are essentially providing the same service as in they're providing news, but they view their roles differently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good way to think about it. And we know from a lot of the evidence that journalists are seeing their work differently. Mm-hmm. And we see this with a new generation of journalists that have sort of, you know, been hired and educated in worlds where, you know, the internet is no longer something that you almost even talk about or think about necessarily. Journalists today assume that their work is going to be circulating and monetized and commodified and shared in these online environments. So I think you're right to say that journalists think about, you know, they think about what kind of headlines they're using. Well, you know, headline writers think about what kind of headlines work for search engine optimization. Journalists will often think about who their sources are and whether sources exist, for instance, on social media. So can you use Twitter accounts as sources, or is sourcing something that should exist separately from social media? Journalists also think a lot about sort of who their competitors are in this networked world. So as we've seen sort of an explosion of news sources, a lot of times, and we know this from evidence, people cannot necessarily tell you where they got a story from or where they saw a story. It may have floated by on their Facebook feed or their Twitter feed. And journalists are often quite aware of that. So they're thinking about, how do I differentiate myself from other journalists on an individual brand level? And how does my organization differentiate itself? So I think it's increasingly, you know, a lot of that thinking about digital technologies and network technologies, it's increasingly baked into and really intertwined with how journalists think about how they work.
I think it's an interesting point there that you brought up about sources. And obviously one of the main impacts of digital technology is the speed at which you can get these things. I mean, someone can send out a tweet instantly or an email to a source, to a journalist instantly. Are sources more or less reliable now? I mean, because in the pre-internet days, someone could have always written a letter anonymously to a journalist or made a phone call. Is it particularly different now in terms of reliability of sources?
I think it's different. I think I wouldn't want to say that, you know, sourcing today is easier or more reliable than it was in the past. I think you've got a different set of signals and concerns to be aware of. So a few cases come to mind where, you know, for instance, somebody, and I talk about this in the book, but somebody like Andy Carvin, when he was reporting on the uprisings and the riots in Middle East and North Africa, in Egypt and Tunisia, especially, he was doing sourcing in a really different way. He was, you know, sitting in his office in Washington, D.C. as a reporter with NPR at the time. And he was trying to figure out what was going on the ground in during these uprisings. And he was doing a lot of really sophisticated verification work where he was sort of reaching out to his networks of contacts. He was flying with Google Earth images and trying to figure out where were images coming from, where was video coming from. He was, you know, in a sense, he was giving us a master class in how to do verification. It was also controversial because he was doing a lot of that verification work visibly. He was doing it in public. And that is sort of a controversial thing to do, is to put information and out to your Twitter feed and say, do you think this is valid? Do you think this is legitimate? Is this source somebody I can rely upon? He was really doing that work in public, in full sight of the networks that he was working with. You know, he says, and I understand why he would say this, he says that that's part of the work of journalism now, is doing that work in public. That's a really different kind of work to do than the older days of, you know, being in the newsroom and doing all that work privately and in a secluded environment, and then publishing a story that you could back up, that you could sort of claim. So I think the sourcing is happening, you know, differently in that way. But a second example, or a second context, is there was a case, the Washington Post, these are world-class journalists. The Washington Post had a case a little while ago where some of their journalists were using Twitter bot accounts, so automated Twitter bot accounts. They were using those bots as sources within the stories that they were making. And, you know, these are automated, these were not people at all. These were sort of automated accounts, very much like the kind that have been the sources of manipulation today. So in that case, the Washington Post journalists, you know, did not have enough sophistication to recognize when somebody was a bot and when somebody was a human. And to a reader, those sources look the same. So the sourcing is different. I think there's sort of, you know, opportunities, but there's also some real serious challenges that journalists need to consider.
Do you think a part of the difficulty of journalists overcoming those challenges is that these technologies are still relatively new to us? I mean, it wasn't that long ago that the journalism school started to pop up, and that process sort of entered the tertiary education space. So that is again relatively new, and now you've got this extra layer of this new communicative technologies. Do you think a lot of it is still people trying to negotiate how best to use these technologies?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point. I think when a lot of internet technologies sort of first came online in a commercial way, you know, just thinking about the older days of blogs and sort of really simple message boards or things like LiveJournal, I think journalists and news organizations saw these as publishing channels. They saw them as sort of like a newspaper, but just, quote, online. It was just, you know, this idea that you would do what you would do, and then you would just put it on a different channel. And news organizations struggled with this for a long time, was, do you consider your print journalists to be separate from your digital online journalists, your radio reporters to be separate from, you know, your digital journalists? And they really went through a period of time, and I think to the work of Pablo Baczkowski here, really nicely traced some of those early dynamics where, looking at how news work was done in newsrooms, where they were trying to decide, was this a publishing channel or was this something different? Was this something new? And journalism schools, and I'm in a journalism school myself right now, similarly struggled with this. And you saw this in curricula where, you know, some schools are still struggling with this, where they say, should we train someone to be a print journalist and then have them go off into the world and do their work online? Or is there something about the training of journalists that's intertwined with the tools and the technologies that they're using? So I think what we've seen, and it's been pretty rapid and pretty recent, is this maturation, this development of thinking about the story as the unit of analysis, the unit of concern for journalists, and educating students to produce in whatever media makes sense for the story. And it's a lot of pressure to put them under, for sure, because they have to learn how to, you know, make packages, we call them, make video packages, you know, audio packages, print packages, and they have to pivot around those. So that's a difficulty in the production side. And then the last thing I'd say on this is we've then got these, you know, the platforms in all of this that are kind of a moving target. So the challenge that we have is I always think you don't want to train a journalist to write stories, you know, for Facebook or for Twitter. You want to train journalists to write good stories that have public importance and significance. We can't have journalists getting so closely tied to the platforms, because those platforms change. They change for lots of reasons that are not reasons that are necessarily good for the news media or good for journalism. So we don't want to box our students or our journalists in to only being sort of, you know, Twitter trained journalists or Facebook trained journalists. So we're asking a lot of journalists, and we're asking a lot of journalism students. And I think that's why it's both an exciting but also really challenging space to be in.
Just on the point of journalism schools, you had an interesting fact in your book where you said journalism schools increased rapidly from 10 in 1920 to 55 in 1928. Why the sudden increase?
Yeah. And then I get into it in the book. Yeah, there's sort of a history of the professionalization of journalism that was happening. And it's a very United States story that I'm telling in the book. But part of it is related to, well, there's a bunch of different kinds of things going on there. So one is that after World War I in the United States, there was sort of this realization that government information offices had basically been lying to journalists. They had been giving journalists purposefully false information about how the war was going. And the government propaganda offices were basically doing this in order to keep support for the war high, for the First World War high. And journalists were, you know, with some notable exceptions, but journalists were largely sort of echoing what the government information offices told them, partly because there was not yet a tradition, a mainstream tradition. There were certainly, you know, watchdog journalists and investigative journalists who were doing this work, but it was not yet a profession that had settled on the idea that its job was to oppose and to question power. And the idea that the government might purposefully lie to you and try to use you as a journalist as their mouthpiece, that was a pretty new idea. And there was sort of a crisis of journalism after World War I. And people like Daniel Hallin have written about this, but also, you know, people like Walter Lippmann weighed in on this. People like John Dewey weighed in on this. There was sort of this question of, what is journalism up to? Is it about giving citizens and residents information to make decisions? Is it about reflecting a social world that's presumed to be stable and unchanging? Is it about convening publics and bringing people together through communities of concern? I think part of the reason you saw that rapid expansion of journalism schools was sort of this post-World War I crisis that the profession's going through, to kind of say, what is it doing? Who is it accountable to? Who is it trying to hold accountable? And what does it mean to train journalists? And those are perennial questions. We kind of still have those questions in journalism schools today, of what it means to do that work.
So you mentioned then about how the role of journalists could be to speak truth to power, for lack of a better phrase. there are a lot of other professions that are in the business of producing and disseminating information. Is that what makes journalists different to other communicators, that they have a role, or if you want to even go further, a duty to speak truth to power as opposed to just put out information?
Yeah, that's a really great point. I tell my students sometimes, I remind them, and again, this is in a U.S. context, but I say, you know, the press is the only commercial institution that's mentioned in the United States Constitution. You know, it's the only business in a way that's called out as having a constitutional, a legal role to play. And I try and talk with them and say, well, why is that? Like, we don't call out medicine. We don't call out, you know, the judiciary in the same way. There's something about journalism. And, you know, the discussion we usually have is to say the power of journalism is to make publics, is to not see publics as these things that you sort of find in the wild and pick up and just report on as if they're completely natural. But this is what communication is all about, is communication is about drawing out commonalities and distinctions among people who are living in solidarity. Sometimes they're living in conflict. And that's the sort of professional but also sort of ethical duty of journalists, is to recognize their role as makers of publics. So I think they're quite different from other content producers, because ideally they have this other ethical dimension to what they do. Now, there can be a wide variety of meanings of what it means to make a public, what it means to inform citizens, what it means to sort of challenge power. There's lots and lots of variation of what that can look like. But if journalists sort of think they're just another kind of content producer, then I got to say, I think you should get out of the journalism business and get into whatever that other business is that you want, because I think you're not really, you're not doing journalism then, you're doing something else.
So in the book, you discuss democratic autonomy and you give a variety of definitions of autonomy. Can you just talk us through some of those briefly?
So a few different thoughts about what sort of autonomy means. We've in a sort of a liberal, small L liberal sort of marketplace model of autonomy. It's sort of this idea that people largely exist independently as fully formed, you know, fully developed individuals. And autonomy is about giving those individuals freedom from forces or others that might impact or interfere with their expression of who they are. So it sort of says, I as an individual am fully baked and who I am, and what I really need from either the government or the markets or the state or some other people, I need you to get out of my way so that I can live my life as I want to live my life. And that's sort of autonomy. And that's sort of a classic, almost Enlightenment era liberal marketplace model of autonomy. And a lot of, especially American Western notions of individualism and autonomy rest on that idea as well. But and this is what the book tries to get into. There's other kinds of autonomy. And one of these is this idea that, and this is Isaiah Berlin's notion of sort of positive and negative freedom. So in Berlin's notion, negative freedom is sort of this freedom to be left alone, to be produced. But there's a lot of human existence and a lot of social existence in particular that relies on people seeing themselves not as fully formed individuals just existing in the world, but people who need other people to communicate. I need other people to do things. I need other people to challenge my viewpoints. I need other people to tell me things that I would not seek out and learn about myself, and introduce me to new communities that I wouldn't seek out myself. So I need to be embedded in a community, a communicating community, that's going to show me different ways of being, that's going to show me different kinds of life I could have. And so this is sort of this more positive notion of autonomy. And what that lands on, what it sort of says is, for me to be a fully thriving, fully, you know, present member of my community, I've got to have these relationships, and that it's actually worse for me as an individual to think that I just want to be left alone and I just want to be seen as an independent individual. So from a speech perspective, a free speech, a marketplace model of free speech says, just let us all speak individually, try to have very minimal barriers to that speech. And somehow this marketplace of speech will sort of add up to the kind of governance or add up to the kind of talk that we need in order to govern ourselves. But a different, this affirmative or sort of positive notion of freedom that is present in, you know, the work of some legal scholars like Alexander Micheljohn or Owen Fiss, this affirmative notion of speech says publics actually need a right to hear speech that they would not necessarily seek out for themselves. I need people to say things. I need communication structures to reveal to me speech that I would not independently seek out. So that's where the notion of sort of a public right to hear comes from, is it says, let's not just go back to this individual marketplace model, this almost sort of libertarian notion of speech. Let's recognize that I need my communication infrastructures to give me a more complicated picture of who I could be.
So you discussed the interplay between freedom and duty and what institutions help autonomy. How does the press help with the process of autonomy, and what, if any, other institutions help?
Ah, that's a fantastic question. So for me, I think about the press in sort of three broad ways. So the press is made up of journalists who are doing their work. They are out there practicing in the world. They're deciding what's newsworthy or not. They are, you know, reporting on some stories or not. They're choosing language to do. So that's sort of the work, the verb of journalism in a way, the verb of the press. And then there's the news itself. The news is sort of this content that circulates. It goes through networks. It appears as, you know, stories or videos or images. And it's sort of the noun in a way of news. Is this the noun of the press, I should say. It's this news content as well. And then the third bit of the press I think about as sort of these structural conditions or these institutional conditions. So these are things like, you know, who gets funding or who doesn't get funding? What kinds of access do some journalists have versus other kinds of access? What kinds of readers are more attracted to or supportive of some kinds of news versus other kinds of news? And these are also these sort of, you know, background, but very powerful forces. So when I think about the duty of the press, it's really to recognize its duty to make publics. And I kind of come back to this. And what I mean by publics, you know, can mean a lot of different things. Maybe we can get into that. But that's the duty of the press, is to sort of be thoughtful. What Don Schoen calls a reflective practitioner. A reflective practitioner is somebody who's able to do their work, but also take a step back and look at the kind of work they're doing and ask these questions of, you know, how far or close am I getting to an ideal? So when I think about the duty of the press, it's across those three levels of, I want reflective practitioners and journalists who are thinking about what they do. I also want sort of the content analysis kind of piece of this that a lot of journalism scholars do, where it's looking at what type of news circulates, what types of things are being said, what types of things are not being said. And then I want this third piece, which is really about these institutional conditions, to say what kinds of journalism and kinds of news could we get if we had different funding mechanisms, if we had different legal structures, if we had different sort of cultural assumptions. So that, I'm not sure if that answers it, but that's how I think about the duty of the press as sort of spread out across those three levels of analysis.
So you've mentioned publics then. Can you just define what you mean by publics and discuss a couple of the different ones that exist?
Sure, yeah. And the book gets into more detail on this for sure. But yeah, there's a few different kinds of publics that we can think about. So one type of public, and this is sort of like a pragmatic, or John Dewey would sort of have this kind of public, where you think about publics are these shared conditions of life that you cannot escape, you cannot remove yourself from. And you can, these are usually public goods. You can think about as like the air we breathe, the water we drink. But you can also think about like public school systems or taxes or things that we we want to devise collective solutions to, because it's, you know, it's good for me to, even though I might not have kids myself, it's good for me to live in a society where people are well educated and have, you know, thriving schools to live in. It's good for me to live in a place where I can reliably walk outside and breathe clean air. It's good for all of us to not worry about the health of the water coming out of our taps. These are sort of shared conditions of life that you can't fully escape from. You can't just devise individual solutions to it. Although, especially in a U.S. context, some people do, right? They send their kids to private schools. They'll have private, private water systems and things like that. So that's one kind of public, Dewey would call that sort of a public of shared consequences. But we can also think of other publics like a Habermasian sort of communicative public, where it's about thinking about publics as groups of people that get together to rationally discuss and to sort of on an even playing surface present information and devise solutions to shared problems. But it's very much this sort of rational exchange of ideas, and the power there is in the discourse, you know, in sort of how that discourse is designed. And, you know, somebody like Habermas has done a lot of work on it. But I'm also thinking there's another, you know, way of thinking about publics is sort of in a Chantal Mouffe kind of way of thinking about agonistic publics, where it's, you know, to oversimplify in ways to say, well, she might say, well, who are we kidding that we're all going to be coming together in these lovely Habermasian ideals of discussion? We need public life that actually makes space for contestation, for competing viewpoints, for actually taking to task the kind of power imbalances and power differences that exist. And somebody like Nancy Fraser would say this as well in terms of her critique of Habermas, is to say, let's not kid ourselves and think that we're living in this lovely, you know, ideal, equitable society. A lot of what public life is about is engaging with those power differences. It is about figuring out what equity and what equality looks like. And that entails contestation. That entails, arguments a lot of times. So that I could go on, but those are sort of some of the types of publics. But it's in thinking about it in terms of the press duty and your previous question, is that a lot of journalists, I think, sort of default kind of to this Habermasian ideal of the public. A lot of journalists will talk about, you know, the rational, informed citizen who is, making good choices about how to vote or how to spend money. And there's sort of, it's this ideal of individual rational action. That's my read of a lot of dominant forces in journalism, is that's what they think they're up to. But there's other ways you can think about journalism. Maybe it's the shared conditions way. Maybe it's a journalism of empathy. Maybe it's a journalism of solution making. Maybe it's a journalism of contestation. There's lots of other kinds of public that the press could be making.
You just said that there were a lot of different ways to think about journalism, and I'm just chuckling a little bit because the next question I found Timothy Cook's research quite amusing because of the conclusion he drew. So you said Timothy Cook's study into journalism, in which he concluded that he has no particular faith in journalism, given that journalists are unelected and it's difficult to hold the press to account. So given his rather pessimistic, I would say, interpretation, how can the press represent the public when, as he concludes, they are unelected people?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I know, and Cook's work is really sort of foundational and really central to the way the book thinks about institutions and sort of journalists' relationship to institutions. But I think accountability can come in a few different ways. I mean, one is that so the marketplace does provide a certain amount of accountability, and that's a very American solution to sort of the problem of accountability. It presumes that, you know, people are voting with their feet and eyeballs and clicking on the things and paying for the things they want to, and that somehow that will provide us with sort of accountability in that way. But I think, I take sort of the public media model a little bit more, is that there's sort of a relational accountability that journalists can be engaged in. So a simple example is, you know, NPR, National Public Radio in the US, has this sort of membership model, this sponsorship model where people become, quote, members of their public radio stations. That is a really, it's a fairly different way to think about accountability when you see your audiences not as people who are going to just, you know, make a decision to move to some other channel or to give you money or not give you money. But if you have this sort of relational aspect of accountability, where you, they live in your communities and they share the same sense of the problems that you might have. In a lot of ways, I think that's just a almost an orthogonal or really different way to think about accountability than markets. It's not that journalists are elected, for sure. To, you know, Cook is totally right. But I think this sort of accountability through relationships is, for me, the most exciting and sort of interesting form of accountability, even though it's really messy. It's really messy stuff to think about how to have a relationship with a news organization. But I think that's where local media, local news organizations are kind of leading the way, is to create, that sort of relational accountability.
People have more access to journalists these days than ever before through comment sections, social media, and the like. Do you think these things could help with the relational aspects that you just described, if people feel like they are able to access the journalist directly?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes and no. I think, and that's where the sort of the design of these infrastructures and design of these platforms really matters. So one thing I think we want to be careful of here is kind of not turning journalists into like the Swiss Army knife of public communicator, where they have to do absolutely everything. And the journalists that I talk to are understandably quite wary and hesitant to, you know, engage with every single comment writer or every single Twitter replier who has a problem with your work or wants more clarification or something. We can very quickly find ourselves turning journalists into sort of public consultation managers, and then they don't necessarily have the time or bandwidth to be able to write the stories and produce the stories they need. So I think, but what we're starting to see, and the book gets into this a little bit, is different types of labor being recognized in news organizations. And some of these take the form of like community managers or audience relationship engagement. They come in very different titles, for sure. But there's a set of people who are sort of tasked with looking at who audiences are. Some of this is data analytics work. It might not be engaging with a commenter directly, but it's sort of looking at patterns of data and saying, where is our audience moving? Where is it coming from? And then it's sort of a hard ethical editorial decision to say, do we want to go where our audience seems to be going, or do we have an independent editorial vision where we want to bring them somewhere else? And we're going to work hard to do that. But I think, and this is part of the explosion of journalistic roles, we can't expect individual journalists to do all of that. So we can give audiences access, but we can't sort of put all that on the individual journalist. Although, can I actually say one more last little thing on this point, is that one of the places where we're seeing this tension play out is in the idea of a public editor, sometimes called an ombudsman. And historically, they've usually been men. So the New York Times sort of famously discontinued the role of its public editor. And the executive editor and the publisher both said at the time, they said, well, we don't need a public editor who is historically charged with sort of being this liaison, this intermediate person who could explain audiences to journalists, but could also explain journalistic decisions back to audiences, right? So the public editor was usually this really rich intermediary role. And so when the New York Times discontinued its public editor role, it made this very telling, you know, reveal in a way, because they said, well, we think all of that audience interaction is happening on social media now. So you can, you know, you can reach journalists through Twitter or through Facebook, or you can do your audience interactions that way. And I got to say, and I've written a little bit about this, but I think that's a real missed opportunity for just devolving this audience relationship to social media platforms and thinking that those platforms, which were not built as journalism, as news platforms, that thinking that a Facebook forum where anybody can weigh in is going to get you the kind of accountability that a really thoughtful public editor would. So sorry, I know it's a long answer, but I think this issue of sort of how audiences and journalists see each other is a really complicated but important one.
So I'll finish on this. So are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of press freedom?
Depends on the day sometimes, but I think I'm overall optimistic, and I think that optimism actually comes, I might have said something different a year ago, but I think in the last year, I think we've seen more of a grappling of the role that technology companies are playing in public communication. And we're getting a better and better critique of technology companies and platforms than we used to have. So I'm beginning to see, you know, news organizations, you know, saying, you know, getting really frustrated with Facebook and how they direct traffic or don't direct traffic, or when Jack Dorsey of Twitter said, well, you know, the problem of misinformation on Twitter could be solved if journalists would just do verification work for us and make the platform better for us. And journalists, you know, largely responded and said, you're crazy. You know, our job is not to make your platform better and give our free labor to do fact checking for you. You got to fix your platform. I'm more optimistic these days because I'm seeing journalists start to get a language and a power in their response to these technological forces that I don't think they had, even 2 or 3 years ago. I don't think they understood how to speak back to platform companies. And that's a broader conversation that's starting to happen now.
So before we let you go, Mike, we just like to finish on to ask the question, what are you working on now?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's great. It's a new book project. It's going to come out with Yale University Press in a little bit, but it's tentatively called The White Space Press. And what I've been thinking about in this book, it's an extension of part of this current book, but really is thinking about the idea of absence and silence in the press and how sometimes absence and silence can mean lots of different things, whether it's, you know, sometimes it's censorship or self-censorship, but other times it's sort of evidence of listening or it's evidence of editorial choices. So it's a bit of an abstract follow-up in a way to the current book, but it's to try to look at this phenomenon of absence or silence or and ask, you know, what does that mean for the press and what does it mean for public making? So it's a short book, but it's a bit of an abstract diversion after being in the weeds of digital journalism.
Well, we'll definitely have to get you back when that one comes out.
Oh, that would be fun. That'd be great.
Mike, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That was Mike Anani and his latest book, Network Press Freedom, Creating Infrastructures for a Public Right to Hear, is available now. I've been Monica Wilkie, and this was a New Books Network Media and Communication podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.